Hello, folks. This is Pastor Butch Paul, and I'll be sitting in for Melody Seastrom for a little while, the next 20 minutes, and then the last part of this broadcast, you'll be listening to Melody and James Corbett on a pre-recorded program. I know you want to hear that, but I'll be in here for 20 minutes with y'all, if you don't mind, and Melody won't take a day off, and I don't blame her. By golly, everybody deserves a long weekend once in a while. She sure does. She does. So if you can bear with me for 20 minutes, and we can get by for a little bit, then thank you for doing that. Don't forget, Melody's out there, folks, and she's ready to help you if you ask her to. I know that from personal experience. Melody Seastrom is the most straightforward, reliable, totally honest individual in the metals market that I have ever talked to personally. Now, that's the truth. You call her at 800-375-4188. 800-375-4188. And talk to her about what she thinks she might want to do for your future. The markets today was something. Now, I'll tell you what, folks. Gold was actually up a little bit, $2.08, $1,467.70, creeping back up towards the $1,500 mark. Silver was up 7 cents at $16.95. The Dow was up 175 points, 27,957, almost 28,000. The NASDAQ was up 46.76 at 85.2590. S&P was up also 17.50 at 3114.17. Wow. And platinum was up $11.97 at 89.21. Palladium was down $26.39, 1707.69. You know, these metals sometimes kind of throw me a curveball. I don't know why one goes up and one goes down like that. I really don't know. I'm not an expert on that. That's why you need to call Melody. The 10-year yield was 1.83, and oil was up $1.02 at $57.79. I mean, it's amazing. Again, the markets are almost a record high. I mean, 28,000. Although, some time back, a year or so ago, maybe longer, I was told it'd probably go to 35 to 40,000 before it went out, and boom. But I'm not holding my breath on that. Don't you all do that either. Don't count on the markets to be your salvation financially. Please don't do that. You're gambling with your future on that. And that's just the way it is with the uncertainty of this country today and the instability of politics in this nation today and the bickering back and forth and fighting among the so-called leadership. This country is just unbelievable. You know, Trump's hearings are live in the House and they're watching every day. And now Giuliani faces a campaign finance probe, apparently. So, I don't know. It's just insane. Whether it's both parties working undercover, so to speak, to bring forth the agenda, or is Trump for real, or is he not? I personally think that he's a lot of hot air sometimes, but there's some things I think maybe he's sincere on. All I know is it's causing chaos. And chaos always brings disaster. It does. It's just an order of things. Chaos brings disaster. So you can go along with it if you like, or you can know that maybe there's a lot more to it than meets the eye, and they're just trying to do something to cover up what's going on behind the scenes. That's up to you. But all this is going on, and I do believe this is one of the reasons we have the cover-ups. The U.S. national debt just hit the $23 trillion mark as we continue to steamroll toward financial oblivion. This week, the U.S. national debt reached $23 trillion mark for the first time ever. There was no fanfare. There were no politicians giving speeches about fiscal responsibility. And there's been very little national outrage. And I agree, I haven't heard any at all. We have simply come to accept that it is normal for our national debt to grow at this exponential rate. But the truth is that we are literally committing national suicide. Given enough time, there is no doubt that this colossal mountain of debt will kill our republic, and yet fiscal responsibility is not even a major national issue any longer. Everyone seems to be okay with the fact that we are stealing more than $100 million every single hour of every single day from the future generation of Americans and destroying the bright future that they were supposed to have. What are we doing to our children and our grandchildren is beyond criminal, and yet very few of us seem to care. Folks, the market's fine. Forget the debt. Don't worry about it. $23 trillion, another record high, big deal. Who cares? You know, kick the can down the road a little further. That's just the way the attitude of the people is. But do you really think that maybe this is part of the reason why this impeachment fiasco is going on? I don't know. I really don't know that, but I just know this thing going on behind the scenes that nobody's paying attention to. The global debt. Now listen to this. The global debt to top $255 trillion by year's end. Did you hear that? $255 trillion. Global debt is on course to end the 2019 is a record high, more than $255 trillion. The Institute of Internal Finance estimated on Friday, nearly 32,000. Pay attention. This is impressive. Nearly $32,500 for each of the 7.7 billion people on the planet. Did you hear that? Nearly $32,500 for each of the 7.7 billion people on the planet. Wow. The amount, which is also more than three times the world's annual economic output, has been driven by a $7.5 trillion surge in the first half of the year that shows no signs of slowing. Around 60% of that jump came from the United States and China. 60%, folks, come from the United States and China. Wow. Government debt alone is set to top $70 trillion this year, as well as overall debt, government, corporate, and financial sector of emerging American countries. Now, the government debt overall, not just the $23 trillion just mentioned, is going to top $70 trillion. With few signs of a slowdown in the pace of debt accumulation, we estimate that the global debt was past $255 trillion this year. So, folks, that is absolutely hard to fathom that 7.7 billion people, if they could pay it all right now, have to pay $32,500 in debt. I bet you a lot of us couldn't do that. I bet you a lot of us couldn't even think about doing that. And yet, we go on. Impeachment hearings going on. No one's talking about the debt. No one talks about the $32,500 that we all owe for a worldwide debt. No one talks about that. It's Trump this and Trump the Ukraine and Giuliani this and on and on and on it goes. And I guarantee you, millions of people are glued to the TV set every day watching these proceedings. I have not watched them. I am not going to watch them. In the meanwhile, of course, another shooting in California, which will mean more outcry for gun control. They don't look at the root cause of all this. Obviously not, but it is what it is. 70% of Americans say they are struggling financially. Folks, 7 in 10 Americans struggle with at least one aspect of financial stability, a new survey finds. About 1 in 5 middle-class workers are spending more than they earn. And I don't know all the reasons for that. Sometimes you can't help it. Sometimes medical bills, other things crop up. You can't help but go in debt. I'm speaking from personal experience on this, all right? I paid off debts that... Oh, wow, I won't get into it. But I'm speaking from personal experience. And perhaps they overbought. If they did, that's their own fault. I'm sorry about that. If you don't know how to balance a budget, you can't run a household. About 20% of women say they are stressed by money compared with 13% of men. Many Americans remain in precarious financial shape even as the economy continues to grow, with 7 in 10 saying they're struggling with at least one aspect of financial stability, such as paying bills or saving money. You know, I'll make a comment here. Paying bills is what most people struggle to do. Saving money almost is unheard of. It's just something that people don't even consider any longer because they can't afford to even pay the bills, much less save money. How do I know that? Folks, I'm 71 years old. I started working when I went in the military. I was 19 years old, went full-time military, and that's when I started working for a living, I guess you could say. And all my life, saving money was almost an unheard-of thing for me. Seriously, I really struggled with it. I had three sons, two of them wanted to go to college, and on and on, the expenses come out, my wife's medical bills, my medical bills. Saving money was almost not an option for me. If I hadn't, by the grace of God, listened to some wise counseling back in the early 90s and started buying when I could, a silver dollar there, a 10 there, a 10 silver dollars there, maybe when they had a little special, or what it may be, silver rounds and maybe a piece of gold when I could afford it. I would have been in debt still today. I'm talking, folks, that it's a long-term plan for me. I just couldn't go out and buy a chunk of this because I didn't have the money. I bought when I could, and I put it back in a gun safe. And by the grace of God, it paid off everything I owed in the house and land 17 years early because I did that. That's the truth. The findings come from a survey of more than 5,400 Americans from the Financial Health Network, a nonprofit financial services consultancy. The project, which started a year ago, is aimed at assessing people's financial health by asking about debt, savings, bills, and wages, among other issues. Despite solid U.S. economic growth this year, the share of Americans who are struggling financially remains statistically unchanged from a year ago, said Bob LaVey, vice president of the Research and Measurement with Financial Health Network. Now, folks, we can look at that and shrug it off if you like, but that doesn't change the fact that it's true. It's getting more difficult as time goes along to make ends meet because the dollar shrinks every day. I know we think, well, we're making more money, my paycheck's higher. Think about this. You got a pay increase. So you start paying more taxes on what you earn, which is totally unconstitutional and immoral, but they do it. And the dollar dropped in value that every day ever since you've got that increase, the dollar has continued to drop in value, which means that you're taking a cut in pay. Most jobs, I would say, if they get a 5 to 8% increase in pay, is a good increase. I would imagine that. See, I worked in sales, still do part-time, for 45 years. I never got a pay increase. I was on commission. But let's say they give you 8% pay increase every year. Real inflation is closer to 10 to 15%. You're still losing ground. It looks like more in the paper, looks more on the tax return. But in reality, you're making less than you were a year ago. I know that sounds kind of maybe absurd, but think about this a minute. Inflation is a tax. Inflation is simply because we no longer have sound money. Fiat currency has to inflate because the more they print to cover their tails, the less it's worth and the more inflation there is. If we had financial stability and had gold and silver as our means of trade, of course it may fluctuate a little bit, but not much because it's pretty well constant of what it's worth in and of itself. Gold and silver prices actually don't change a lot, folks. The fiat currency fluctuates around them, up and down. It looks like, well, gold's dropping in price, or gold's going up. No, the dollar's worth less or worth more. Depends on what happens that day. But gold and silver are constant. An ounce of gold, an ounce of silver, is still going to be an ounce of gold and an ounce of silver tomorrow. Now, whether they make more of it, if they make another one, a two or ten, it doesn't make any difference. It's still going to be an ounce of gold, an ounce of silver. They're not going to inflate it by making more of it. It doesn't work that way. Gold and silver are real financial means to do business. And barter is also, but I will tell you now, folks, if you'll pay attention to somebody like Melody Cederstrom and do what you can when you can, if the world goes on long enough, I was blessed to live long enough to see it happen in my life. I started in my early 40s, I'd say, well, middle 40s, I was 43, I think, 44, when I started looking at this and putting back a silver dollar here and there or silver round when I could. And something like 10 years ago, paid everything off. So, yeah, I was blessed. But I listened to wise counsel. That's all I can tell you, folks. Wise counsel is something that you must understand. That when Melody talks to you, she's not trying to con you. She's the most honest, precious metals dealer that I've ever talked to. And from what I can see, the most reputable also. Listen to this. Elizabeth Warren. Listen to this. Elizabeth Warren's tax plan would bring rates over 100% for some. Isn't that amazing? Over 100%. How does that work? Presidential hopeful proposed a wealth tax and levy on unrealized gains, a combination that could alter investing. No kidding. A Democratic presidential candidate wants to boost taxes to pay for an expansion of health care, education, housing, and other programs. Democratic presidential candidate Warren has unveiled sweeping tax proposals that will push federal tax rates on some billionaires and multimillionaires above 100%. I ain't grasping how that's working yet. That prospect raises questions for taxpayers and the broader economy that experts are starting to ponder. Under which circumstances would taxpayers have to pay those rates? How might that change their behavior? And when would investment and economic growth suffer? Duh. Potential tax rates of 100% could result from the combination of tax increases the Massachusetts city proposes for the very top tier of investors. She wants to return the top income tax to 39.6% from 37%, impose a new 14.8% tax on Social Security, add an annual tax of up to 6% on accumulated wealth, and require rich investors to pay capital gain taxes at the same rates as other income, even if they don't sell their assets. Wow. And she's a front runner. Oh, my people. We for years, I grew up in a common at the time. If you probably don't remember, a lot of you don't. Nikita Khrushchev was the prime minister of Russia, and remember him beating his shoe on the table at a meeting one day, and he said he's going to bury America and not fire a shot. And I hate to say this, but it come true. He said America would hang herself, and they would sell us a rope to do it with. Socialism, creeping incremental socialism, started back in the 1920s with Social Security. The first check by way of Social Security was paid to a lady, I don't remember her name, but she was $22 and some odd cents. She only paid in that. She paid in 20-something. Her first check was 20-something. She lived to be quite old. She drew out $20,000, but only paid in $22. The way this works is they tax the next generation. As long as the workers outnumber the retirees, you have a chance of making it work. Unfortunately, in America, we've murdered about 100 million unborn babies. They were future taxpayers. Not to mention all the ones, the millennials who aren't working or don't want to work. So the Social Security Ponzi scheme is going to collapse. I don't know when. I'm not setting a date. I'm not that intelligent to do that. But a Ponzi scheme always collapses sooner or later. So it's just absolutely amazing to me that this has happened. It's been on this long. And people still think it's going to be all right. Knowing that if we would put money in an account and receive 10% a year for what we invested, and we invested in Social Security, we'd all been retired millionaires. But we bought into the lie, as we still are today. Elizabeth Warren still catering to the people and pandering to the people that way we'll give you something for nothing. And people not realizing it's going to cost them everything, especially the freedom. Now, the next two segments you'll be listening to Melody Seastrom and James Corbett, and I promise you they'll be a lot more intelligent than I am on this. But I hope you didn't mind me being with you for a few minutes today. I really mean that. I enjoyed being with you, sharing what I can with you. By the grace of God, I will see you next week, Melody, on Tuesday and Thursday. Y'all have a wonderful weekend.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Seederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Seederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Seederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk CommonSenseTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And as you know, many of you know that James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report, founded in 2007, and in 2012, James became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster. And of course, we know the International Forecaster was created by Bob Chapman. And you can visit James's website at thecorbettreport.com. thecorbettreport.com, and you can also request a complimentary copy of the International Forecaster by going to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. Welcome, James. It's always great to have you here for, I call it, our conversation.
Indeed. Well, I enjoy our conversation, too. Let's pull up a cup of coffee or tea and get into it.
Yes. Let's get started. There's so much going on. I mean, topic, but right now, as we talk, the House Intelligence Committee has completed day one of its public impeachment inquiry. Of course, it was featuring testimony from Ukrainian Ambassador William Taylor and Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent. You write that this sordid affair has a much deeper and darker story that, in your words, blows the lid off the left-right nonsense that so preoccupies the political normie land. And you discuss a couple of things that you claim were not being told. Would you like to talk about them?
Yes, I would.
One by one.
Yes, I would, because this is obviously a story that is going to be preoccupying the nation of the United States for the next who knows how many weeks, months, or years they drag all of this on. And it is an irony that I know is not lost on the right side of the left-right divide, that this is essentially one of those maneuvers that turns a scandal around on itself. So here's an example of that. A few years ago, we were told that the Russians hacked the American elections by exposing how the DNC rigged the elections. But you're never supposed to think about that second part of that. What were in these hacked emails, quote-unquote? Actually, I don't think they were hacked. They were leaked. But anyway, even if they were hacked by the Russians, what do those emails from the Democratic National Committee actually show? It showed that they were actively engaged in rigging the process against Sanders and in favor of Clinton. So the dastardly Russians undermined democracy by showing how the DNC was undermining democracy. And we have that exact scenario playing out right now, where that dastardly Trump is doing a quid pro quo on Ukraine foreign aid by attempting to show how Joe Biden was doing a quid pro quo on Ukraine foreign aid. You can't make this stuff up. It's so crazy. And maybe that's part of the point of this, that at the base of this story, and I don't know how much this is, because I don't really follow the mainstream coverage of this day to day. I just I don't want to preoccupy my brain with it. But I wonder to what extent people even realize that the scandal at the base of this scandal actually involves Trump trying to dig up dirt on Joe Biden and what Biden admitted to at the Council of Foreign Relations last year, specifically where he told the CFR meeting, yeah, he was bragging about it. Yeah, I got them to fire that Ukrainian prosecutor who was accused of corruption, and I said I was going to withhold this billions of dollars of aid unless they got rid of this guy in the next 6 hours. And you know what? They got the son of a whatever he said at that time, and he was very proud about it. He was literally saying, I was withholding foreign aid for a quid pro quo. We wanted to get rid of this prosecutor. And who was the prosecutor? Oh, it just happened to be the prosecutor that was going after Burisma Energy, which was the Ukrainian gas giant that had brought Hunter Biden on its board a couple of years ago when the U.S. was running its Ukraine coup operation. And so literally, Joe Biden was protecting his son. Or at least that's one reading of events, and people are going to, other people will say, no, the prosecutor wasn't going after Burisma and blah, blah, blah. But whatever way you cut it, literally, it was a quid pro quo that Joe Biden was doing with the Ukrainian government over foreign aid. And now the base of the scandal is Trump was trying to do a quid pro quo with foreign aid. It's just ridiculous. And then let's add the second layer of ridiculousness to this story, foreign aid. As if this is shipments of wheat and rice to poor starving Ukrainians or something. No! What aid are we talking about? We are talking about billions of dollars of lethal military aid that's going to Ukraine, the Ukrainian government, the installed coup government, that is there specifically to be a bulwark against Russia, that is part of this op that was waged several years ago to overthrow the Ukrainian government and replace it with a U.S.-friendly Russia enemy government. And that's what this is about. It's about military aid, as in guns and bombs and Lockheed Martin googads and gadgets, like tanks, which, admittedly, the Ukrainians don't need and aren't using anyway. But guess who convinced Trump that it was even a good idea to go ahead with these types of military this type of military aid? It just happened to be a guy who was on the board of a lobbyist that was working for Lockheed Martin, which, oh by the way, gets the contracts for the javelins, the anti-tank weapons that the Ukrainians are buying. So again, foreign aid, as if we're just helping the poor starving orphans of Ukraine. No, this is literally military weaponry that is being purchased from U.S. military contractors, obviously at taxpayer expense, and then shipped over to the Ukraine. This is what this is all about. And I don't think, I don't know. I'd love to do a poll of the average American and see if they have any idea about this background.
Well, it is interesting, and you know, the thing of it is, we can compare Biden, we can compare Trump. I just figure, you know, when Biden was doing this, where were the Republicans at that point in time? I mean, they're all hush-hush. I mean, they don't do anything. Democrats are a little more vocal, do a little. I mean, it really is.
It just goes to show the extent to which the conversation can be directed, dependent on where we are asked to turn our attention. If we had been asked to turn our attention to this and to Biden a few years ago, we could have had a very similar proceeding going on, except then it was the vice president rather than the president. I guess maybe that makes a difference. But no, it would have been the same thing. It's just that no one wanted to direct our attention in that way at that time. Now they do want to direct our attention. So now it becomes possible to talk about, but don't ever mention the background to the story.
So where does it all end? Is this going to be theatrics and good grief?
Yeah, exactly right. And so this is where you get into everyone takes their side and picks their favorite. Oh, I'm a Republican, so I'm on Team Trump. Therefore, let's point out the Biden part of this, but let's not investigate too deeply into what aid is being offered here and why and what it involves and who was the contractor who put this deal together and who's making money off of this. And then the Democrats will pick their corner, and I'm anti-Trump. Therefore, Biden is perfect, and I love him, and Trump is the one who did everything wrong, and it's just exonerating your own side. It's just more of the left-right divide nonsense, which overall I think is designed to get people at their most base, primal, tribal level, get in the corner of Team Blue or Team Red, choose your side, and then fight with the other side. And this is the weaponization of the political system itself that has obviously ratcheted up in recent years to the point where I'm sure you can remember, not casting your mind that far back, a time when you could politely disagree with someone on politics and move on to other conversation. But I think that's decreasingly possible in this highly, highly, highly partisan age, to the point where every conversation becomes about politics and every conversation becomes an argument. That seems to me like it's been weaponized against the public. And everyone who plays into this political paradigm is part of that problem.
It is. Conversations become very hostile, and we look further into the future. Where is it going to lead us? Social unrest. I mean, there's so much anger out there. But I also, yes, we were talking about this the other day. You know, we view it as politics, but I view it as something a little bit deeper, that people are so easily guided at this stage of the game is because of the economy and because of the deeper divide. I think people are restless because, you know, they're not getting ahead. I think, you know, people are restless because they don't have the jobs, they don't have the security, and they're looking for something else, and I think they latched on to politics. And
yeah, I don't disagree with that assessment. In fact, that was a fundamental point that I was making. I did a series of reports about the left-right political divide and what actually can unite people instead of driving them apart. And this was several years ago, you know, before the Trump era and all of the craziness we've seen in the last few years. But several years ago, I was pointing this out, that when you looked at the base issues that at least were what we were asked to believe were the roots of something like Occupy, the Occupy movement, and the roots of the Tea Party movement, before both of those movements were clearly spun off and controlled and brought back into the Democrat, Republican, left-right political bickering. But at their base, there was a popular movement on the left against the banksters, against the people that were controlling and funding and the bankster bailouts and all of this crazy nonsense that was going on. And then the Tea Party, which at its base and before it got taken over by the Republican Party, was against the bankster bailouts and all this nonsense and the economy being left by the wayside. There was absolutely at the base of both of these movements, many, many people from both sides of the political aisle were on board with the same fundamental problems and seeing the problems from in the same way, but then it gets spun off into the political debate. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing. Fundamentally, I think you're right. There is so much of the economic and financial at the base of this, and the politics is like this lens that is put over top of the camera, so you see it in a different way. If you see only, you know, if you're on Team Red, you only see the reds in the picture. If you're on Team Blue, you only see the blues, and then you argue about the red and blue. But you don't actually talk about the base, fundamental, underlying reality that everyone is, in one sense or another, screaming about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so much anger and hate, and it's certainly being used. And you know, we're talking about the economy and so forth. President Trump was at the Economic Club of New York on Tuesday, and you know, the prospect of completing an initial trade deal with China soon, but there's never any new details on negotiations or even what's in this trade agreement, supposed phase one. Are you hearing anything on your side of the world about this, any trade agreement? Does anybody really care except here in China? And do you think there will or won't be a partial trade deal?
I think people do care generally, and especially in the Asia-Pacific region. I think it affects all of the economies here, including Japan and everyone else. So there is a great deal of interest in this. But as you say, I mean, how many times have you seen that headline in the last couple of years? We're on the verge of some sort of agreement. Oh, talks are progressing. We're almost there. Oh, we've hit a little snag on farm purchases is the new one that Wall Street Journal is talking about. But yeah, as I've been saying for months and months now, I'll believe it when I see it. None of these promises of some deal that's right around the corner have ever eventuated into anything at this point. I think it is, yeah, at this point, it's just hype and talk and hot air. And it misses the main point of the issues anyway. I mean, fundamentally, I think the issue that will be the determinant factor in the 2020 selection circus that's coming up there in the United States is not going to be the U.S.-China trade deal. It's going to be the Federal Reserve and what the Fed does. And this is kind of the elephant in the room that everyone acknowledges but no one talks about, is that, yeah, the Fed is determining at this point, determining the economy. Will they cut the rates? Will they raise rates again? They literally can decide which way the economy is going to go because it is all based on their paper promises and phony baloney nonsense. And as long as people buy into it, they will be able to do that, to control it like a switch. So in a sense, I really think the Fed is going to determine this selection. If they want to crash the economy before the election, they can do so. And that would probably cost the presidency for the incumbent. No matter what degree of, you know, craziness and phoniness there is in the bought and paid for voting machines and all of that level of stuff. I mean, at base, people can be swayed against the incumbent by a poor economy. We all know this. And this is, it's the power of the Federal Reserve at this point, where the central banks are determining economic reality. And we get caught talking about these promises of some Chinese deal that's never going to arrive anyway.
Well, he also talked about the when he was at this Economic Club of New York, he also talked about, you know, the Fed. He talks about negative rates. He says we're actively competing with nations who openly cut interest rates, so not many of them are actually getting paid when they're paying off their loans, et cetera, et cetera. He wants that. It sounds like he wants negative rates. And no one ever mentions why are negative rates such a bad idea. It's beyond me, James. It's not accepted.
Even that the rates themselves are the bad idea. It's that they represent the fundamental gaming of the system. The fact that the system is made up of paper promises that mean nothing. You couldn't do this in a hard, sound money system. It wouldn't be possible to have negative rates, but it is possible in this phony baloney paper system of fiat paper promises. And you're exactly right. I mean, when Trump was the candidate running for president, then it was in his interest to say, oh, the Federal Reserve is goosing the economy and helping out Obama, and look at this, you know, they're cheating in the wrong way. Well, let's go the other way. Why don't they put the rates back to something that resembles reality, and we'll see what the economy really is. And then when he becomes president, he's arguing that you should go into negative rates. Everyone's doing it. You know, this will give us the advantage. Goose the rates for me. So, I mean, that's it in a nutshell. It's the fundamental underlying hypocrisy of it all. Of course, the candidate is going to complain that the Federal Reserve is propping up the economy, and they shouldn't do that. And then when you get into power, they should do that for me. That is the system in a nutshell.
And everybody goes along with it. That's what always is always so baffling. You know, it's just everybody just accepts it. And there was Edward Griffin. He recently said, we are living in a system of the banks, by the banks, and for the banks. And that really isn't new. It's always been the system of the banks, by the banks, and for the banks. It's always been like that, hasn't it?
It has, but I would say that the extent to which that is true has increased in recent years. I mean, you could certainly make the case, at least since the creation of the Federal Reserve in the United States, that the U.S. economy has been essentially controlled and directed by the banks, and that is demonstrable. But there has been a change since the 2008 crisis and the bailout laws and the various things that were passed as a result of that, and now heading into the negative interest rate world. I mean, things are getting crazier and crazier to the point where you might actually say, well, wouldn't it be nice to just at least go back to, say, early 2000s or the 1990s or something like that, before the central banks literally and openly, it's not a secret, everyone acknowledges it, literally control the economy and everything that's happening in it. That probably isn't a good idea, but we have reached that point, and it is now the point where not only do people accept that, they expect it. As we now know, you know, investors are pricing in the next rate cut for the Fed. So if they don't do it, then the economy is going to collapse, so they have to do it. It's just nonsense.
We're heading into a break right now. That's not nonsense. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my guest, James Corbett, the founder and editor of The Corbett Report. James, your most recent article on thecorbettreport.com is called The Saudi Aramco IPO, What You Need to Know. You write about the world's largest oil company getting ready to offer the shares of the company. And there's three issues that you believe are raised by this action and Saudi Arabia's role in the coming New World Order. Can you tell us about that? Yes.
Gladly. So for people who don't know, Saudi Arabia has been talking about this for a couple of years now, that they are going to offer, and the number has been floated around, I think, for a couple of years, that Saudi Aramco, obviously the state oil company, one of the largest companies on the planet, depends how you value it, but once it gets its valuation from this IPO, it is almost certain to be the highest valued public company on the planet, and will leapfrog over Apple and Microsoft and leave them in the dust. Now, the question is, what will the valuation be, ultimately, when all is said and done? The Saudi crown prince, effective ruler of Saudi Arabia at this point, Mohammed bin Salman, has been, from the outset, insisting that Saudi Aramco is worth $2 trillion and will be evaluated as such. But the bankster analysts are disagreeing. In fact, there's been a wide range of reported potential valuations from $1.2 trillion all the way up to $2.3 trillion, which... actually, come to think of it, $2.3 trillion. Oh, yeah, that's the exact amount that Donald Rumsfeld talked about on September 10th, 2001. There's a lot of question marks hanging over this IPO, and there has been for years. As I say, they announced it a couple of years ago, then they held off, and then they were teasing it again, and then it didn't come through, and finally they've put out their official announcement of intention to float. And at the time that I wrote this article, the prospectus hadn't even been issued, so there were still a lot of question marks about it. Exactly, will this be 5%? Where will it be listed? How much will be listed where? These types of questions. Update, since writing this article, the prospectus has been released, but there are still questions that the prospectus does not answer. For example, for individual investors, how many shares will be available? When precisely will they go on sale? What price will they be offered at? These things are still up in the air, at least from what I've read. The prospectus is 658 pages, so you'll excuse me for not having read through it all with a fine-tooth comb myself yet. But if you want to, the links are up there in the comments of my article up on CorbettReport.com. But I think it is fascinating just as an IPO itself. It will undoubtedly, assuming it goes ahead, it will be the largest IPO in history by a long shot, dwarfing Alibaba's $21.7 billion flotation in 2014. 5% of Saudi Aramco, we're looking at 60, 70, hey, who knows, $80 billion, it's going to be a very, very large offering. And an important one, not just economically. This isn't just financial. This is geopolitics. Because something that I've stressed in my in what I've talked about for over the years, including in my big oil documentary, is that Saudi Arabia and the oil is an exceptionally important part of the monetary system as it exists right now. The petrodollar system that people, I'm sure, have heard about is not just some sort of euphemism for talking about oil and its importance. It is a literal system that was created in the 70s to basically catch the dollar When Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard, the idea was, well, it's going to be, I mean, how do we continue to ensure that it is the world reserve currency, and why would people price things in dollars? Well, one important linchpin of that, not the only one, but an important one, is that Saudi Arabia was brought in on an agreement that Kissinger worked out where the U.S. is going to provide a military umbrella and protection for Saudi Arabia and the House of Saud specifically, as long as they make sure to price their oil in dollars, and as goes Saudi Arabia, so goes the world oil markets and OPEC generally. So oil is priced in dollars internationally for the most part. Some upstarts in the Shanghai Exchange, etc., have come up in the meantime, but for the most part, oil around the world is priced in dollars, and this drives a demand for dollars, and also Saudi Arabia takes a lot of its oil dollars and recycles it back through the U.S. banking system, so that's an important part of this system. Anyway, long story short, this is a geopolitical event when Saudi Arabia starts selling off its stake in its state-owned oil company. It's one step towards what Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has said is the future of Saudi Arabia, is moving toward, away from oil, diversifying from oil, and towards technocracy, essentially. Technology, I'm sure they'd try to frame it. Things like creating a $600 billion, or whatever the price they're putting on it, NEOM city in the desert, where they're going to literally create a desert, a city from the sands of the desert out of nothing, and it's going to be this futuristic city of complete, total technological surveillance of everything, and robot dinosaurs and flying cars, and that great description that I read about NEOM when it was being proposed a year or two ago was, this is like how an 8-year-old would envision a city of the future. And that's, I mean, it really is off the wall. But anyway, this is the idea. Saudi Arabia is going to transition away from its dependence on oil as the lifeblood of its economy towards, well, what's the next big thing? High tech. And this is an important part of the narrative that I painted in my documentary on why big oil conquered the world. Because as I stressed in that documentary, oil and its importance and the oligarchy that formed around it, the Rockefellers and others, was never really about oil per se. It was about the control that came from cornering the market on oil, which was the lifeblood of the economy of the 20th century. The lifeblood of the economy of the 21st century is increasingly data. What you can do with data and the ways that you can control the population through data. And as a part of that, I think Saudi Arabia is trying to get its fingers into that pie and create the technocratic state of Saudi Arabia. Anyway, that's kind of the big long-term vision, and a very, very small baby step towards that is starting to sell off the crown jewel of Saudi Aramco. And in those years when they were teasing the idea, we're going to start selling Saudi Aramco, the idea was floated at one point. It was apparently being considered quite seriously that the House of Saud would just outright sell 5% of Saudi Aramco wholesale to China, which is a pretty big thing. If that had eventuated, would have been a pretty big thing, because of course part of the whole petrodollar system and the whole deal that goes on between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia is it's the U.S. and Saudi Arabia's relationship. But Saudi Arabia, well, suddenly U.S. is not the world's major top importer of oil. Now it's China, and China is hungry for all this oil, and China is the partner that wants to partner up with Saudi Arabia. And so if Saudi Arabia starts to move away from the U.S. umbrella towards the Chinese umbrella, well, that could be a pretty major thing. And in fact, China, they have been trying to solicit China at least as one of the sort of anchor investors in Saudi Aramco's IPO. So again, this portends a much bigger shift geopolitically and in terms of the future of the planet, really, than simply an IPO of a big company.
Well, you know, Aramco owns the largest refinery here in the United States, and, you know, the relationship between, it seems, with this administration and the prince, you know, it's certainly growing stronger. I mean, the amount of funds that are being funneled to them for the war in Yemen, and no one talks about, but could it be that the United States is building this relationship so they would, they could, how can I say this? Would they change the connection of the petrodollar to the data dollar?
Yeah. Yeah. Is it going to go? And in fact, we saw Mark Carney, outgoing Bank of England governor, just a couple of months ago, saying that the world will be transitioning to a new world reserve currency. It's just a matter of time because the dollar isn't going to cut it. And he did float the idea of Libra, you know, the Facebook quote-unquote cryptocurrency, which isn't crypto at all, maybe that could be a world reserve currency at some point. So maybe they are, I mean, I think we are being prepped to move in that direction. Of course, this will be controlled, bankster-controlled, non-cryptocurrencies, but digital currencies. But I think we are moving in that direction ultimately, although there may be some intervening steps in between here and there. But yeah, I think the U.S.-Saudi relationship is interesting, and it does say a lot about world geopolitics generally. And one thing that I've talked about for years, and I think it's very important to understand with this relationship, first of all, I think there's a difference between the Trump administration and its relationship to Saudi Arabia versus the some of the other power factions in Washington that have other agendas. And I think there has been an attempt to sort of demonize and distance the American unelected aristocracy, whatever you want to call them, the foreign office, foreign council on foreign relations, that kind of class, and from Saudi Arabia. And we saw that, for example, with the Jamal Khashoggi killing, and things like that. This are little stakes driven through the heart of that relationship. But Trump and Mohammed bin Salman seem to have enjoyed and continue to enjoy close relations, and you know, the big Saudi arms deal a couple of years ago and all of this. So there's different power factions even within the U.S. itself. But one thing I've always stressed for years now is that as essentially there are back doors in that agreement, or trap doors that that have been planted, so that, for example, if Saudi Arabia did try moving more out of the U.S. umbrella and inching into the Chinese umbrella, or starting a relationship with Russia, or you know, whatever the State Department boogeyman of the week is, there is a type of limited hangout, or at least a sort of trapdoor in the official 9/11 story, to blame 9/11 on Saudi Arabia. It was the Saudis that did 9/11, as if every finger pointing back, pointing out at the Saudis, doesn't have four pointing back at Washington and Bandar Bush and all of that. But that idea has been part of the 9/11 official story that was then covered up in the congressional investigation, the 28 pages, for example. And now this idea we should allow the 9/11 victims' families to sue Saudi Arabia for 9/11. This has always seemed to me like it is an implied threat to the House of Saud. You will play ball, you will do what we want, you will maintain our petrodollar system, or we might open the floodgates and we might, it was Saudi Arabia that did 9/11. Now we have to overthrow the House of Saud. Whatever. I mean, we can imagine how that will go, or could go. And that seems to me part of this relationship. So it's an uneasy relationship, I think, in a number of ways, and an unstable one that I think will change. I think we're seeing the pivot. In the coming decade, I can't imagine that the U.S.-Saudi relationship as it exists now will continue to exist in the same way. It's just a question of how this is all going to play out.
And I'd also have to assume that this transition that's going to happen in the next day, it's not going to be pleasant. I mean, mm-hmm. It isn't going to be a nice, easy little transition, you know, with, you know, the dollars coming out of the, I mean, I would think that it would, before we get to any other type of world reserve currency, there would be some sort of a world depression. Recession,
it is
depression.
Difficult to imagine that playing out in any other way. It's difficult to imagine somehow that the entire world monetary system is going to change over in some pleasant way that works out right for everyone. I mean, there are always going to be losers, and especially in those big changeover events. And it usually involves the collapse of an old empire, like the British Empire in the early part of the 20th century, giving way towards the U.S. Empire, which is what it has become, quite clearly, as the old system was transferred into the U.S. dollar reserve system. Or and of course, what came along with all of that, and where did the current U.S. dollar world reserve system come from? It was from Bretton Woods, which of course was the conference that was held towards the end of World War II. So world wars and changeovers of monetary systems have gone hand in hand in the 20th century, and I think generally speaking, changeovers like that don't happen because of pleasant circumstances. There's generally massive geopolitical strife and turmoil, and a lot of people get crushed under the wheels of those types of machinations that take place.
General Miley, who chairs the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, agreed with Japanese officials earlier this week that a three-way cooperation with South Korea is key to regional security, and that an intelligence-sharing pact between Tokyo and Seoul should not be scrapped. South Korea has announced plans to scrap the general scrutiny of military information agreement amid disputes with Japan over trade and wartime history. James, do you think the U.S. pressure will be enough to save the agreement, or is this one between Japan and South Korea?
Well, I can say that the trend here, or the trajectory, is not a good one for Japan and South Korea. This dispute, this spat, that has really been kicked up in the last 6 months. And of course, it's about a lot of underlying tensions that have been there for years, decades even, going back at least to World War II, if not before. But for some reason, the last 6 months, it's really been exacerbated, and it seems to be picking up steam. Japan and South Korea are getting bristlier and bristlier with each other. So I'm not sure that the U.S. is necessarily going to be the glue that's going to hold this together. Or maybe they are the only glue that is holding this together at this point. But is it enough? Is a very good question. I think we see, as long as the trend continues, we are going to see a widening rift between Japan and South Korea, which is exactly the wrong way that we want things to go, assuming we want things like peace on the Korean Peninsula. Because obviously Japan, I think, has to be a part of that conversation that's going on right now. And if Japan and South Korea can't even form some sort of united front, then how on earth is this going to work with North Korea in the mix, and then throw in China and the U.S., and things get very messy. So to have relations collapsing like this is not a good thing. And it looks, at any rate, that this is not going to be resolved anytime soon, and certainly not just by the U.S. waving some kind of magic wand.
And not a whole lot of discussion over here about North Korea of late either. That's kind of been on the back pages of late. But you know, it's again how things move so quickly, and our time is up. Also, that has moved very quickly. And I want to thank you for joining us tonight, James, this afternoon. And we always appreciate your views and insights, and we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. And listeners, thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. So until then, we'll be back on Monday. And until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.